Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Liz Tung, in for Mike and Scott. A few months ago, I was at the vet with my cat, Ahab.
So it is a wonderful, rainy Friday morning. I am standing under the overhang at Companion Animal Hospital in Philadelphia.
Ahab's a fluffy, generally good-natured little tuxedo cat, but this morning, she was not happy.
I know, baby. I know you're not happy, but it'll just be half an hour and then we can go home, okay?
This is a voice I'm sure most pet owners are familiar with. It's the voice we use when we're trying to sympathize with our pets.
Oh, look at your little angry eyes.
This is one of the hard things about having pets. At least with kids, at some point, you can explain to them what's happening and why. That thing they hate, going to the dentist or getting shots, is for their own good. But with animals, you can't explain things to them. You just have to try and do what's best and hope they trust you enough to bear with it. Ahab's pretty much always been an indoor-outdoor cat. She likes going out in the evenings to patrol our backyard. And she's usually back before I go to bed. But this time, she came in limping, holding her left leg up. It was too late to do anything, so we went to sleep. The next morning, I saw her limping from her litter box back to bed. So I picked her up to carry her the rest of the way, and she screamed. I didn't want to drop her, so I rushed her over to the bed. And then I put her down softly, and she glared at me and gave me one final really angry meow. I don't think I've ever felt worse in my life. Because, as it later turned out, she had dislocated a joint in her leg. After a trip to the emergency room, she came home with a hot pink cast.
No. No chewing on your cast.
She was gnawing on it constantly. Soon, she'd chewed holes in the hot pink plaster till strings of frayed gauze were poking out. The vet told us that could be dangerous. She could get a blockage in her gut. So my husband and I reluctantly put a cone around her head. Seeing my proud Ahab like that made me want to cry. She kept bumping into things. She couldn't even eat without the edges of the cone getting in the way. We had to put her dish on top of a teacup so the cone could fit around it. I kept finding excuses to take it off, like that she needed to groom after eating. But then, right away.
Ahab, do you want the cone to go back on? She's chewing on it already.
Stop it.
Stop it. Stop it. Okay. The cone has to go back on.
Don't look at me like that.
That's my husband, Wooly.
Okay, Ahab. Sorry, we have to put the cone back on if you're going to chew on it.
It was a tough time for all of us. And to make things worse, now I had to bring her back to the vet on that rainy Friday for a bandage check.
Other questions or concerns?
I don't think so. They're going to call me. Mm-hmm. When, okay, yep, that's it. Bye, Ahab.
I knew I was doing the right thing, but I still felt awful. Especially as I watched the vet tech carry her away. It's a feeling I think a lot of us have when we're trying to do the right thing for our pets.
A tough choice I've had to make for my pet this year, Captain, was they told us that we should probably get surgery, which is really scary for a small little dog that's 15 years old.
Here's my story about Grits. He went out in the backyard, got bit by a copperhead. So we rush him to the emergency vet where they tell us we can get anti-venom if we want, but it'll cost a couple thousand.
My dog Dipper is a rescued Yorkie mix with a great smile but terrible teeth. In April, I had to scramble to find a vet open and willing to do dental work on him.
When you think about it, the decisions we make for our animals pretty much define their entire existence. From what they eat, to where they live, to the minutiae of how they spend their days. Most of us even decide, on some level, how long they live. And when and how they die. And that's a big responsibility. So on this episode, we're thinking about what that responsibility means, the decisions we make for our pets, and how we make them. let's stay with Ahab. This all started a couple years ago when I was trying to decide whether or not to let Ahab outside. Think of it as a prequel to her current drama, the story of how we got here and why I feel so terrible. I told the story to our host, Mike and Scott.
What is it, Ahab? I want to go outside. Okay, fine.
And I'm just going to show you a picture of her.
All right, she's cute. Little black kitty with a white nose. She's a sweet cat?
She is an adventurous cat. She likes to play, she likes to go outside and hunt.
Do you want to go outside? But you've already been outside like 3 times today. All right, I'll let you out. She's running outside. She just jumped up. Oh, and she's standing on her hind legs, peering through the fence into our neighbor's backyard. You see anything, Ahab?
And that was pretty much her life for the first 3 years.
Little tail is wagging. Her ears are all perked up. She's sniffing the wind.
So then we moved to an apartment where we couldn't let her outside. And we tried to play with her as much as we could, but we could see her getting frustrated. Here's my husband, Wooly.
Well, definitely. I mean, in the flat after that, I really started to notice, again, because she couldn't go outside, that she was a little bit angsty. She bit me once. And she'd never really done that before. She'd never been aggressive or anything. And I think she was just bored. I think she just, like, lacked the stimulation.
I guess that's understandable. If she was, you know, she was always outside and now she's stuck in this little tiny place.
Yeah, and it wasn't just that she was bored. It's like she actually seemed miserable. And this is something that Wooly and I started talking about a lot, like pretty much on a weekly basis.
Because if you think about it, like she's a little life form and we know what happens to people when they're in like prison. Like it's really not good for your mental state. You know, it's always a toss-up between keeping her safe and not letting her outside, but having a cat that's depressed and unhappy and might act out a bit, than having a cat who has the freedom to enjoy life.
So you're psychoanalyzing the cat at this point. So what did you decide to do? What happened next?
So we eventually moved someplace with a yard where we could start letting her outside again. And then we decided to book an appointment with a vet so she could get all of her shots. And while we're there, the vet, like, completely freaks us out. He starts listing all of the horrible things that can happen to cats when they go outside. You know, get hit by a car or get in a fight with another cat, get some kind of disease. And then he finishes with, if you value your cat, you will not let her go outside.
Ooh. So what did you do?
Well, at first we kept her inside. And I mean, I was surprised by what he said. And so I started searching around online to see what other experts say. And I ended up reaching out to this researcher who studies how environment affects cats' welfare. Her name is Candace Crony.
I'm a professor of animal behavior and well-being at Purdue University.
And I was actually surprised by what she said.
There's no standard blanket answer in terms of what's best for the cat. That really is just a function of what you're looking for, what your definition of good welfare is, what makes for good quality of life for an animal.
So that's a little bit different than what the vet said.
Yeah, and this is actually a question that she poses to her ethics class at the veterinary school there.
It's simply the case of which cat has better quality of life. So I give them a case of the indoor cat living a long and possibly relatively boring life indoors versus the cat that is outdoors or indoor-outdoor. It's very well exercised. It's very mentally stimulated. And at the relatively young age of 5 years old, meets its nemesis, the moving car at high speed. And then the cat says goodbye to us all. And I'm almost always shocked that people pick cat number two, almost every time.
But do you really think cats get depressed when they are not outside? Or is that just a human emotion that we put on them?
So I was actually wondering that, and I reached out to a cat behaviorist who you might have heard of.
Hey, everybody, this is your cat daddy, Jackson Galaxy. Here
he actually had this show called My Cat from Hell. And this is what he said.
Yeah, of course I've seen depression. As a human, if you knew you were on this planet to do one thing, and that one thing you were not permitted to do, you would also be anxious and depressed. And from a DNA standpoint, they are programmed to wake up, hunt, catch, kill, and eat.
So this is what cat behaviors call the seeking circuit. It's this part of their brain that drives them to hunt and releases dopamine when they do.
Is there any way to strike a balance, so to give the cats this excitement, but also keep them safe?
Yeah, so that's actually what Jackson teaches owners to do, and what he was trying to advise me to do, is just play with your cat more.
There's so many ways that you can split the difference, and it is definitely a harder parenting choice to do the work, you know, as opposed to open the door.
So, Liz, what have you and Wooly decided to do with Ahab now?
She is still going outside. We are talking about it. But I have told Wooly that, especially after hearing once again all of the horrible things that can happen to cats when they go outside, that I really do want to try and bring her in. So currently making plans to see about making that happen.
Close the door.
Close the door. As you can probably guess, I did not stick to that promise. At least not until 2 years later, when Ahab came home with a limp and had to stay inside with her little pink cast for almost 2 months. You might think this should have been a clear lesson for me, but even now, it's not. In fact, bioethicist Jessica Pierce says this: the question of whether or not to let cats go outside is one of the trickiest issues she's come across when it comes to making decisions for our pets.
It's not an obvious right or wrong to me. It's really a gray. And I have struggled with that tremendously as a cat owner. And I've kind of flip-flopped from being kind of aggressively indoor only to thinking that that's unkind and letting my cat outside.
I wanted to talk to Jessica because she's an expert on the ethics of keeping pets. She told me about her cat, Lovey, who she and her family adopted when Lovey was about 10 years old. Up until that point, Lovey had been an outdoor cat.
She would stand at the sliding door and just meow and meow and meow. We finally decided we got a cat door, and we said she can make the choice. And she did. She was so happy, and she lived a very happy life for 3 years with us, and then she disappeared. So, of course, I have terrible feelings of guilt and responsibility for that. But I still feel like it was the right choice for her. And maybe it's different for every cat and every cat guardian.
Jessica says there's no good answer to this dilemma. And for now, she's not planning on getting another cat.
I don't want to have to make that decision. I don't feel comfortable having a cat who's not allowed outside. Some people are, and I don't think that it's wrong to feel that way, but I don't feel that way. So the moral problem for me is too profound, and I just won't have a cat.
That might sound extreme, but Jessica's thought about this question pretty deeply. The result was her book, Run, Spot, Run, in which she draws on science and philosophy to explore the ethical implications of keeping pets, including whether or not we should keep some of them at all.
I was a mother of a child who had a keen interest in having pets. And so, you know, we had over time accumulated a couple of dogs and a cat and some rats, a gecko and a snake.
Around the same time, she started researching animal cognition, how they think and feel and experience the world.
And I started to feel more and more uncomfortable with the state of captivity that a lot of the creatures who shared our homes had to endure. Thinking of the gecko, for example, you know, we did the best that we could at the time or that we knew of at the time, but this poor creature in a tank, really with nothing to do, And over time, I felt the accumulation of all these little eyes looking at me, like, what are you doing to us?
She became really troubled by the thought of an animal, all alone, all day in a cage, and started to think of it as something much more disturbing.
What you really could only call solitary confinement, a single hamster or a single gecko or a single goldfish in a small cage or tank, and expected to live out their entire life with essentially no kind of environmental enrichment. And there's actually substantial literature into the experience of boredom in animals. And anybody who's been to a zoo has probably seen a polar bear, you know, doing a figure of eight, pacing back and forth in his or her cage. Is basically, that's a behavioral expression of profound boredom and frustration. And, you know, the same thing I think occurs with our pets. We put them into environments that are really have nothing to offer them. We expect us to be everything that they need, but we're not.
Jessica's research opened her eyes to the rich inner lives of animals.
The fact that we don't experience the world in the same way they do doesn't mean that they aren't having interesting experiences of their world. And what we do when we make them our pet is basically take them out of the world for which they have evolved and put them into a really foreign environment so they can't use their powers of cognition to do the things that they have evolved to do.
So you did an entire exploration of dog cognition. What were some of the most interesting things you learned about how dogs experience the world? And did that have any bearing on ways that you think we should treat dogs differently?
The main difference between the way humans experience the world and the way dogs experience the world is obvious if you look at our faces. If you looked at me next to my dog, Bella, she has a much more prominent nose. And, you know, humans are primarily visual animals. We experience the world through our eyes and through visual stimuli. Dogs are animals who live through their nose primarily. So their experience of the world is really through sniffing things, through the olfactory sense. A lot more of their brain power, their cognitive processing, is dedicated to processing information from their nose. And how that translated to a change in my behavior for me was it changes how I walk my dog. Given a choice, a dog will spend approximately a third of the time during a walk just sniffing things. So if you're going to take a 30-minute walk with your dog, 10 minutes of that might be just sniffing stuff. For us, that means might be 10 minutes of standing around just waiting for our dog to sniff. You could write a whole book about the ethics of walking dogs and doing it well. You know, if you watch people walking their dog and you see a tight leash, it's probably a sign that there's a mismatch between what the dog is wanting to do and what the person is wanting to do. And you see people kind of tugging on a leash and saying, come on, there's nothing there. You know, for the dog, there's actually a lot there. We just don't see it.
So part of the basis for justifying making decisions for our pets is the idea that they don't necessarily know what's best for them. And, you know, sometimes that seems to be borne out when we see our dogs and cats do really stupid things or, you know, like eat a stick of butter and get sick. So I know that you've explored different animals' cognitive abilities. I'm wondering, what does science tell us about animals' ability to make good decisions?
So, you know, in a naturalistic setting in the wild, I would say animals are prone to making good decisions, otherwise they don't survive. When we are talking about companion animals who were asking to live in human environments, I think the calculation is a little different. So, you know, for example, dogs don't know that cars on a highway are going to kill them. So bringing them into these human environments, we have a responsibility to protect them. I think of it a little bit like free range parenting, like being a helicopter parent to too great an extent. You just don't let your child have any fun or develop any skills that they need to be safe. So I think there's a kind of an irony, which is with our dogs in particular, the better we have them trained, the more freedom we can give them. And it sounds a little like an oxymoron, like you spend all this time sort of teaching them to be obedient and to obey our commands, and that's restricting their freedom. But it actually, I think, allows them a lot more opportunities out in the world.
So your book, Run Spot Run, has been billed as sort of like a case against pet ownership, and you explored a lot of these really complicated issues. When you finished writing the book, did you come down on an answer about whether or not it is ethical to keep pets?
My own answer to the question is, I guess you could call it a sort of sliding scale of suitability of animals to happy lives as pets. For me, dogs are the least complicated morally.
Dogs and cats, she says, have been with us for thousands of years. They've evolved with us. But wild animals like foxes and tigers, those are a no-go.
Animals who have to be in a cage for their entire life, so fish, birds, geckos, you know, I think probably no. You know, for them, there's no benefit to being our pet. It's only a loss. And if it's for the sake of entertainment, to me, that's not a strong enough justification for locking an animal up. And then, you know, some cases that I would say are kind of marginal are the pocket pets, like hamsters and gerbils and guinea pigs and rabbits. I think they can have good welfare. They can have good lives as pets, but it takes a lot more work than most people put into it.
Jessica Pierce is a bioethicist and writer. Her latest book is called Unleashing Your Dog, A Field Guide to Giving Your Canine Companion the Best Life Possible. Here in the U.S., it's common for people to keep their dogs, at least some of the time, in crates.
I am a proponent of crating dogs for house training purposes. So my dog learned that his crate was his cave.
That's Maria Ross Estrada. She's a veterinarian and professor at North Carolina State University College of Veterinary Medicine.
We say the man may have a man cave in the house. Well, my dog had his crate, and that was his dog cave. But the thing is, the crate has to be a place that your dog wants to go, right? It's not a punishment, but this is your private sanctuary where you can go, where you have a nice, fluffy bed, but you can't leave your dog in a crate 16 hours a day. That is barbaric and is inhumane.
It's all based on the idea that dogs have a denning instinct, a need inherited from their wolf ancestors to seek out safe, confined spaces. It's basically become conventional wisdom in the U.S. that crates are the way to go. But last year, when Pulse reporter Jad Slaman was thinking about getting a dog, he wanted to know, does the science really back that up? Here's Jad with more.
Half the dogs start barking as soon as I walk in. But not Scrappy. He's this black spaniel mix, and he stands out because he's so chill. He just checks out my microphone, lying on his side in a kennel at the Morris Animal Refuge in Philadelphia.
He was adopted and returned back a few months ago. Actually, maybe about a month ago.
That's J.R. Rogers. He's a caretaker here. He says Scrappy has actually been shuffled between a few owners.
Adopted, return, for certain reasons.
That's the case with a lot of the dogs here. Some bite, some hate the cat or the kids. Another big reason? the dog doesn't take to the dog crate, these locking cages usually made of metal wiring.
They get like stressed out, agitated, and start biting bars and start yelling and screaming.
Crates are big enough for the dog to stand and turn around in, but not much more. JR tells me they're pretty common in the city, where most people live in smaller places, don't have yards.
They buy crates from Petco or PetSmart and crate train them. And sometimes some dogs not used to being crate trained. They may try to hurt themselves, abuse themselves by biting the wires of the cage and cutting their gums because they've never been crate trained before.
Crate training, at its most basic, means keeping a puppy in one of these things for housebreaking. The idea being they'll learn to hold it rather than soil in a confined space. But crating is also widely used with adult dogs, basically to keep them from destroying stuff when left alone.
It's the first thing we teach.
That's Annalise Curtin. She's worked as a dog trainer, and she says the crate is good for both the owner and for the dog.
And regardless of how old the dog is, because you need the crate because it's their safe space.
But all the guidelines I could find on how long to use a dog crate are super vague. Basically, no more than 4 hours for a puppy, all the way to less than all day and night for an adult. So I ask, what about a full 8-hour workday?
It's totally fine. As long as the crate is introduced properly, like if they had separation anxiety and were freaking out in the crate, then they need to see a trainer because you have a risk of the dog injuring itself.
I called up a bunch of other trainers and they all told me this exact same thing. With proper training, the crate is actually calming, tapping into something natural for dogs.
They are den animals, and when introduced properly, it allows them to just relax and feel safe. Just, you know, it's somewhere for them to go. You know, in the wild, wolves hung out in caves, you know, and dens and stuff. So, like, it's just in them.
She's referring to what's typically called a denning instinct. Popular online trainers talk about it all the time.
Here I have his little den set up. I have puppy-approved
toys. But dogs are denning animals. Ultimately, they like it dark.
It's like a safe spot. Dogs like to be in dens or small areas. They concur.
The idea is dogs seek out confined spaces, make dens out of them, like their wolf ancestors. The denning instinct pops up all over. It's the very first line of the U.S. Humane Society's dog crating page. But the strange thing is, even though I kept running into it, I could never nail down where the denning instinct idea comes from. What study? Whose research?
Well, it comes from...
Is it bullshit? I mean, is it just...
It is bullshit.
That's Carlo Siracusa, a veterinarian and behaviorist at the University of Pennsylvania. He says it's true wolves have a denning instinct, but the idea that dogs have one too, Carlo says that comes from pretty flawed science, these old observational studies.
The majority of them were done in the 70s or earlier. They studied dogs and wolves in captivity, starting from the assumption that because they are closely related species and one is the ancestor of the other, they were in some way comparable.
They noticed something big. There was constant aggressive competition. It appeared to be the defining behavior, both in wolves and in dogs.
Aggression is part of their regular way of communicating, so the whole dominance thing came out.
If you've ever heard a TV dog expert talk about alpha dogs or pack leader or whatever, this is where that comes from. This constant competitive aggression was the common thread that tied wolves and dogs together in the minds of some researchers and trainers. They figured if dogs and wolves share this core trait, they probably share a bunch of other behaviors, denning being one of them. But all this aggression wasn't actually natural. Carlo says it was just the result of the stress of captivity. And with more recent research, the gulf between wolf and dog behavior grew much wider.
We learned that they are two different species. They don't do the same thing, and they actually don't do the same thing well.
That's true for denning. Dogs don't do it on a regular basis. Mama dogs will den briefly, right after pups are born, and male dogs just can't be bothered at all.
They are like, I did my job, I'm out of here.
But by the time all this was coming out, the older, flawed ideas of wolf-dog similarities and denning were already widespread. Media mentions of denning first start cropping up in the 80s in a syndicated newspaper column.
The Family Pet,
It recommends dog crates for all kinds of behavior issues. One clipping has instructions to write an education fund for more info. It looks like it's linked to a poodle breeding group. They put out this pamphlet.
A Pet Owner's Guide to the Dog Crate.
It's unclear who actually funded it. The author passed away.
Cruelty or kindness? As the pet owner sees it, it's like a jail. It's cruel. I'd never put my dog in a cage like that. If this is your first reaction to using a crate, you are a very typical pet owner.
And you'd be wrong, typical pet owner in the 80s, because...
If your dog could talk, he would tell you that the crate helps to satisfy the den instinct from his den-dwelling ancestors and relatives, and that he's not afraid or frustrated when closed in.
This pamphlet talks about dog crating as already long trusted by breeders and dog pros. It could be part of the seed that got regular dog owners to start using them at home. Pet training professionalized in the 90s and early 2000s. Some big names used crates, some of them on TV and later online. I talked to a big crate maker, Midwest Homes for Pets, to track when sales started taking off.
And you guys are a metal company? Or you started as a metal company?
Yes. So Midwest Metal Products is our parent company. It was founded in 1921. The first product they made, I think, was called the Cruise Switchbox.
That's spokesperson Tara Whitehead. She tells me they also used to make wire rubbish bins for trash burning. Then, in the 50s, the company caught wind some guy in Detroit was buying these things in bulk, using them to keep dogs.
I'm not sure what his industry was. I don't know if he was a breeder or a rescue or just a guy that had a lot of dogs. But
the company tweaked the design of their bin, made it into a crate. The Sears catalog picked it up in the 60s. By the 80s, they were selling so many, they created a separate crate-focused business. And today?
We're doing more and more sales year over year. It's not slowing down. It doesn't get affected by recessions.
Their most recommended product is an adult-sized crate with dividers you remove as the dog grows from puppy into old age. Market analysts tell me about a third of all dog owners have a dog crate. Or I should specify, a third of all American dog owners.
La libertà di movimento deve essere adeguata alla razza.
That's Carlo again, the pen behaviorist.
I cani che hanno a disposizione una superficie di movimento.
Another reason I wanted to talk to him is because he's from Sicily. He's reading an Italian animal welfare law.
It says that the space that an animal have to have, it's a minimum of 20 square meters.
That's 215 square feet, a large living room. Again, a dog crate just has to be big enough for the animal to stand up and turn around.
The difference is huge.
And it's not just Italians. Carlo has worked as a veterinarian all over Europe. He says crating just wasn't a thing. The same is true in Australia. In Sweden, it's actually outlawed. I spoke with Emma Almquist, a Swedish Hund instructor, and she recalls only ever reading about it in American pet books.
I read in those books that you could teach your dog to go in a crate and feel happy in the crate and sleep in the crate. And I was like, yeah, okay, I guess. That's nice, but why?
She says owners there are expected to devote months to puppy-proofing their homes, training, instead of looking to a crate.
So I didn't really understand why.
It's a close to uniquely American practice, at least as a routine part of dog ownership. Carlo thinks part of it is convenience, and this American idea that if you want a dog, it's your right to have one.
Here is more, is far less common for someone to tell to another person, maybe you should not have a dog, right? And many people will get offended, but it's very common in Europe that people will tell, I don't think you can get a dog, like you have a crazy life.
He says even if you make them cozy, these crates are not dens. They come with locks.
Let's say a dog is afraid of noises, right? There is a sudden noise and they get scared, then they cannot run away. Or even something as simple as not just running and hiding, but just running around to dissipate your anxiety. It's something that we do continuously with humans. We pace when we are nervous. Some dogs like to do the same.
He doesn't say never use a crate or even never leave a dog in a crate when you go to work. But he says you always have to interrogate. Are you doing this for your dog or for you? How is this member of your family experiencing all this?
Our love to animals is not enough. We might love animals, but if our condition now were not ideal to keep an animal, maybe we might think, is my love enough for that creature? Probably it's not.
He tells me I can really and truly love my dog with all my heart.
But this love does not necessarily correspond to empathy.
Here, Carlo stresses something. The crate shouldn't be the rule, the norm, but that's not just because it's small. You can leave a dog alone in a huge backyard or give him run of the entire house, but more than space, dogs need our presence. They need us to be there.
What we have done with selection, we have twisted this sociability of dogs and oriented it towards humans.
Through purposeful domestication, we chose the dogs that loved us the most, that wanted to be near us the most, generation after generation for thousands of years.
We have done this with selection. We have created an animal that is very dependent on us to pee, to poop, to eat, to do anything.
Dogs need us. We made sure of that. Some studies show they prefer humans even over other dogs. Carlo says, with this in mind, there's a danger the crate can become an excuse. To stay out later, to take your time getting home from this errand or that. He's in a crate, it's his den, he likes it, and, well, it's locked. Not like he can tear up the couch. I took all this to Annalise, the trainer I spoke with earlier. I told her none of this is real. Denning, alpha, pack leaders. I told her about Italy and Sweden. But she tells me there's something else at stake.
A lot of the dogs I trained were going to be put down because treat training didn't work for them.
Vets and trainers would tell owners their troublesome pets were out of options.
And they're like, oh, there's nothing else you can do. You have to put this dog down. So I was working with dogs who literally, I was their last resort.
Some dogs just didn't learn with treats or clicker training. In these cases, the crate was the only thing that worked, the only thing that kept them from destroying the house.
My main thing is just don't put the dog down if it doesn't want the treat. that's just what kills me.
Annalise doesn't train anymore. Part of it, she says, it got too heartbreaking. One owner admitted to her he wished he could get rid of his dog, just start over with a new one that was less of a hassle. So maybe the crate can do some good, make dogs easier for us, and maybe that keeps some from getting returned to JR at the animal refuge, or worse, to an overflowing kill shelter. I still really want a dog, but crate or no, what's clear now is a dog is a bigger commitment than I thought. Maybe more than a lot of us think. And I'm not there yet. But back at the Morse Animal Refuge, I did linger a bit in the cat room on my way out. I may just head back for another look. Cats are easy, right? I mean, they sleep all day, they go in a litter box, you don't have to walk them.
That was Jad Sleeman reporting. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Liz Tung. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, it's a decision all pet owners dread.
The decision weighed on me a lot, and I found myself really kind of depressed about it because, you know, it wasn't a decision I really wanted to make. I would just pray that the Lord would take her and I wouldn't have to make that decision, but obviously that didn't happen.
So how do you know when it's really time? That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable, quality health care for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Liz Tung, in for Mike and Scott. One of the hardest decisions a pet owner has to make comes at the end of their animal's life.
When is an animal suffering enough that they would wish to be released from life, which is so precious to them?
That's bioethicist and author Jessica Pierce again. Jessica describes some of the end-of-life decisions she had to make for her dog, Odie, in her book, The Last Walk.
And I have chosen euthanasia for two dogs. Extremely difficult choice to make. And I think you always wonder, did I do the right thing? Did I do the right thing at the right time? Was it too soon? Was it too late? There's a lot of second-guessing, a lot of guilt.
It's something reporter Grant Hill and his family recently went through with their own dog, Emma. He tells the story of sending Emma to the big farm in the sky and the tough decisions that came before it. Here's Grant.
The saddest thing about growing up is discovering all those magical places that filled so much of your imagination as a kid. Let's just say, really aren't so magical. Right now, I'm at the final frontier of depressing destinations. Today, I'm at the farm. You know, the farm. The one where your parents told you your childhood pets went to go live happily ever after with all the other animals. The farm from which there is no return. Well, obviously the farm is not a farm at all, at least not this one. I'm in a small building at the end of a long driveway, lined with gravestones etched with names like Lucky and Buttons. An employee named Megan Cianci has guided me into a room painted in calming colors. A large window is cut out from an interior wall, allowing us to peer through at a capacious metal box that looks like something a train conductor might shovel coal into. A fuzzy purple blanket covers a thing that appears to be lumpy and stiff on a table in front of us.
And for a lot of people, pets are their fur babies. I mean, there's a lot of people that they don't have children, they have pets.
Megan is a bereavement counselor here at this pet funeral home, crematorium, and cemetery in central New Jersey.
And is it common for people to witness their dogs?
A lot of people need closure.
She told me a surprising amount of pet owners elect to stand right where I'm standing now and watch their deceased animals enter the crematorium. Today, she's helping another pet owner, me. Underneath that purple blanket in the room is my dog, Emma. My family got Emma when I was in fourth grade. I'd been begging my parents for a dog for too long, and they finally budged.
At the time, Dad and I were both working, and, you know, we didn't want you or your brother to come into an empty home.
That's my mom, Iris Hill. She and my dad set very strict terms when we first got Emma. She was to be my responsibility. I had to do all the dirty work, but, of course, it never quite works that way. Still, my older brother and I were made to sign a contract, ensuring we would take care of her. And from then on, Emma, a Welsh Springer Spaniel, reigned over our house. She never quite became the over-affectionate greeter my mom imagined. Emma was sort of regal, a little standoffish, even. She would sit just far enough away from you that you really had to make an effort to pet her. So, whenever Emma let her guard down to rub her snout on your leg or gently lick your toes, it felt special. Like she secretly loved you the most. Emma was 94 in dog years when she died. At the end, it was hard to remember a time when her dark red and white fur wasn't all faded and bristled. One day she randomly came in from the backyard with a limp. She would never really walk straight again. She was just old. During the last year, everything, even just breathing, was clearly a struggle for her. She became known as the troll downstairs because the kitchen was her territory, and she would let you know by sluggishly pacing and snorting until you let her lick your plate after dinner. Then, she started to pee all over the house, looking confused, eyes glazed over like she didn't know if she was inside or out. To us, it looked like she felt bad about her accidents.
You know, I think we kind of knew that it would progressively get worse, and the medication did help for a little bit, but, you know, and we tried the doggy diapers. You know, we tried that. We tried a lot of different things.
We blocked off whole sections of our house with caution tape to prevent accidents in high-risk areas. There was no chance of her jumping over it. We hosed down countless rugs, started buying 409 in bulk. All that might seem crazy if you don't actually own a pet.
So I see some people go through heroics that don't necessarily benefit the patient.
That's my uncle, Mike Petrano. He's been a veterinarian for over 30 years, and he's seen many clients go to extremes to keep their pets alive.
There are some type of cancers that dogs, cats get that we can say no matter what's done, it doesn't really buy them good quality time. And I will say that people who have elected to treat those cancers, maybe chemo or whatever, most of them do regret putting the animal through that for 3 months.
Like he said, when it comes to senior pets, he advises his clients on treatments based on whether it will give the animal more good quality time, which is markedly different from just more time. We struggled with this as a family. We saw that Emma was suffering, but we couldn't bring ourselves to let her go.
The decision weighed on me a lot.
That's my mom again.
And I found myself really kind of depressed about it because, you know, it wasn't a decision I really wanted to make. I would just pray that the Lord would take her and I wouldn't have to make that decision, but obviously that didn't happen.
Even in old age, Emma was still way too stubborn to make anything easy on us. So we had to set a date, which we eventually did. But the decisions didn't end there. What followed after was a bizarre menu of grim choices. Would she be more comfortable at home for the procedure, or would that make her feel like we were tricking her somehow? Did we all want to be there for her during it, or would watching it be too traumatic for us? The forecast looked beautiful for the coming week. Should we let her have a few more days of gorgeous weather? Then, finally, the day came. My Uncle Mike was on his way to our home with his kit.
Well, I remember trying to be outside with her until he got there because, I don't know, I just wanted her to be able to be outside, you know? And we had pizza, you know, and she had her pizza crust. It was like we were home, all home for her. It was very difficult to see her go, but we can't be selfish.
Two weeks later at the crematorium, I'm making small talk with Megan and my Uncle Mike. He had personally brought Emma over here from his office, where he keeps the bodies of his clients' deceased animals in a big freezer before they can be processed. An employee lifts the blanket to prepare Emma for the last leg of her long journey home to the farm. She doesn't look cold or anything. For the first time in a long time, she doesn't look uncomfortable at all. Megan reassures me it's common for owners to witness their pets go in to make sure the cremains they receive are really their pets. But I didn't have to. I nod. They ask me if I'm ready. I'm not. But I find a little comfort knowing no one ever really is.
That was Grant Hill reporting.
I don't want to leave you on the farm. I don't want to leave you on the farm. I don't want to go.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu and Jed Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Liz Tung, in for Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Leaves fall to the ground. It's a sound that reminds me of you.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.